fascination with American politics and the position of their president reached fever pitch here last year, wouldn't you agree? Yet the experience of the other great office of democratic leadership, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, is much closer to our own system. This month, as I said, it celebrates 300 years of life, and it's being trawled over for its past, present and future, with maybe some resonance for our own governing system. Prior to April 1721, when Sir Robert Walpole became the first official Prime Minister, the King or Queen simply appointed someone First Minister. My, how things have changed. One of the several people charting this saga is joining us now, Sir Anthony Seldon, a well-known commentator on contemporary politics and history in the UK. He's written about the last five PMs, and he's presenting the flagship BBC series on the 300th anniversary. His latest work is The Impossible Office, which is pretty eloquent about his research and whether the post can stand the test of time. Welcome to Saturday Extra, Sir Anthony.
Geraldine, great pleasure to be on Saturday Extra. Thank you for having me.
Sir Anthony, 55 prime ministers in 300 years does sound like a lot of change, and it's left me wondering, does this amount to a superb channel to, in effect, supplement the society that is changing so much so that it's supple? Or is it a bad sign of instability?
Well, obviously, the 300 years has seen unbelievable change. The first Prime Minister, Robert Walpole, never left London apart from when he went to his palace that he built for himself on the profits of being Prime Minister in Norfolk. So that's 100 miles to the north of London. Never went anywhere else. And his pace of communication, it was all a horse and it was the speed of a foot. And of course, Boris Johnson today travels at the speed of sound almost and communicates at the speed of light. I mean, everything has changed. And so the 55 prime ministers, the ones who've done best, Geraldine, have been the ones who've adapted the country to the change. And they have anticipated historical change and been ahead of it. The worst have done very little.
Do you think many of them enjoyed themselves? And I ask this for a very definite purpose, because the people looking on at their leaders, do you think they want to see someone growing and changing, or do they want to see someone effortless? Or, you know, what's the expectation?
That's a good question, obviously. When I invited Tony Blair, Prime Minister for 10 years, on the BBC programme accompanying the book, whether he enjoyed Prime Minister, he said, not really. And I think that's quite honest, because it's not a great job, and you have to wonder why people would want to do it, not least because nobody or hardly anybody succeeds. They don't really get their agendas through. They have lots of battles. People criticize them and trash them. And then when they, and try to assassinate them, which has been a constant theme, and then when they leave office, it's very hard for them to find anything respectable that they can do. So you have to wonder, why on earth would you do this to yourself and to your spouse and your family if you have one? And even the pay is derisory as the Prime Minister compared to running a company or even running a school in Britain. So, you know, tricky business. And
so it's the seduction of power, is it?
I think it is the seduction of power, yeah. I mean, you know, you've gone into politics and you're ambitious. You think you know best. You think you're better than other people. And nobody says no if the crown's offered you and people say, look, here is the crown, we're going to put it on your head. Nobody, hardly anybody says, you know, I don't think I'm going to do that.
No, well, as we remember from Yes Minister, so beautifully described, Sir Robert Walpole was the first to hold the office in 1721, but you say there was no fanfare, it was just another ordinary day in Britain. Why then was the office created in the first place?
Well, it wasn't a decisive moment, like granting an independence to a new country with a new prime minister or president. It was just the king, King George I, who had come to power, and he needed somebody in parliament who would get his business through, get his money through. He needed to have a strong leader, because following the 17th century, when a lot of power was lost from the monarch, and one monarch, Charles I, lost his head, Parliament gained more and more power, including the power of the purse. So ultimately, the king, George I, needed a leader in Parliament, in the House of Commons, who would do his business, do his bidding for him, and he turned to Robert Walpole. But it wasn't called Prime Minister at the time. That was a term of abuse. It just gradually evolved into that title from First Minister or First Lord of the Treasury.
I'm going to try to draw out from you today just some of the sort of, not so much the details of the history, but the longer term implications for the role of leadership in modern democracies. For instance, last year we spoke to the English journalist Harry Lambert, who'd spoken to 15 Tory MPs, I think it was, about their views on the Prime Minister and Number 10. And the general theme, Sir Anthony, was of discontent, that they didn't feel they had a role in Parliament, that government was conducted at Number 10, not in the halls of Parliament. Now, is that a more recent development? And if it is it quite serious?
I think it is serious. Obviously, it's not just a British phenomenon. Everywhere in the three branches of government, the judiciary, the legislature, and executive, it's been the executive which has tended to dominate and to keep Parliament, the legislatures, under their thumbs where they can, unless you have a system like in America, US, with a separation of powers where the president does not sit in Congress. So in Britain, as long as the Prime Minister has a significant majority of MPs in the House of Commons, which he or she needs to be remaining in office, you have to have a majority, you have to get your vote through. If you've got that, you don't really need to care very much about Parliament. So if there's a landslide victory, as Margaret Thatcher had, as Tony Blair had, and now as Boris Johnson has, you can pretty much ignore Parliament, because your own MPs will be whipped through the lobbies and they're always desperate for office and they don't want to offend Number 10. So, and Prime Ministers have been very cavalier for 40 years. They've tended to ignore Parliament, not go there very much. They do parliamentary questions, PMQs. But apart from that, they'd sooner be dead, frankly, than spending a lot of time in the House of Commons, in the tea rooms, in the bars, being shouted down by their MPs and being criticised and asked lots of difficult questions.
Yes, I do think you make a very good case for the role of a majority in good governance, actually. That's not just stability, but the perception of good governance. Yeah. And, of course, we've got a very closely hinged parliament here, and it does feel pretty febrile, shall we say. Imando Annucci wrote a very interesting piece the other day in The New Statesman about the structure of this. He said, "My concern is not so much whether the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, was up to the job, but why we have a system that couldn't do anything about it when he so clearly wasn't. So when he was, you know, suddenly got so desperately ill with COVID, as he says, all we were left with was a Dominic Raab caught in the headlights, too powerless to decide for himself what to do, and with no system in place for even collective decision making to go ahead." It was really pretty vivid, you know, looking on from Australia, that.
Well, I think we can over-dramatise the fact that that when Boris Johnson did get ill, there was a process for the successor to take over. I do argue that there should be institutionalised a deputy prime minister in Britain just for that kind of eventuality, so that we'd know who was going to be taking over. Of course, it was the monarch who used to decide who the prime minister was. When that power was lost effectively under Queen Victoria in the 19th century, and then with the last brief flicker in 1931, it's been the politicians themselves who have to decide who the party leader and therefore the prime minister is going to be. But I think having a deputy prime minister would institutionalise it. But I think too much perhaps is made of there being a potential constitutional crisis. If Boris Johnson had died, Dominic Raab would have taken over. There would have been a process, and it would have resolved in a typically British muddled kind of way. We muddle through, don't we?
Well, one of the areas where I think you and Mark Garnett, another man who's written a book on this, has talked about the muddling through on military matters, that in fact in the past, a lot of the people who are prime ministers had had military experience themselves. Much less is the case now. Do you perceive that as a problem?
Well, what I think an even bigger problem is that PMs, the office has become ill-balanced. The first PMs for the first 120 years of the office were also Chancellor of the Exchequer, i.e. in charge of financial and economic policy, and they had the Treasury, which is by far the most dominant government department in the UK, as in many other countries. And the PM had that, and the PM was the master of economic policy. They didn't do foreign policy. There was a great foreign secretary who was the great maestro of foreign policy and government, and there were some almighty foreign secretaries. What's happened is that the PM has been prized out of economic policy by the Chancellor, who's the second Lord of the Treasury, who's done more and more themselves, and the PM have started meddling in foreign policy more and more ever since after the First World War. Lloyd George became involved in the Versailles and the Paris Peace Conferences. PM love foreign policy. They're dealing with other leaders. They're jetting around the world, trying to sort out the intricacies of health insurance and pensions in British domestic policy is often rather a pain in the backside for them. They'd much sooner be, grand figures parading around abroad. So I think that that hasn't been a good tilt in Britain. I think the office is very ill-balanced now. And that means that PMs have become involved in foreign adventures. The Suez Crisis, 1956, disastrously under Anthony Eden. The Iraq War in 2003, I think you have to say that was a tragedy for Iraq.
Right, and Iraq, yes, sure.
And in 2011, David Cameron got involved in Libya, which destabilized the country, still destabilized 10 years later. PMs have meddled in foreign policy, which is not their natural territory, and they're not equipped. Over the road in Downing Street, you've got the mighty Foreign Office that has the experts, and I think they should have been doing economic policy much more, which is the heartland, spending decisions, the heartland of what they should have been doing. So, I agree with you.
So, Anthony, final question. Is it an impossible office, as your book title suggests?
You know, it is a possible job, but they need to come into office knowing what they want to do with a clear agenda, and they often haven't had that clear agenda unless it's been a war that thrusts the agenda on them. And they need to know how to do the job. And they've been younger and younger. I mean, supremely talented, like Blair and Cameron, incredibly intelligent people, but they haven't known how to do government. Their lack of experience of any ministerial offices beforehand has really told. They spent a lot of time learning to do the job, and just as they're knowing how to do it,
someone tosses them out.
Is it impossible? Well, no, it's not impossible, but the way they try and do it has effectively made it impossible to really pack the punch that the country needs to move it forward. To come back to your first question.
Well, I just must ask this, because you say part of the issue is that there isn't enough known and sort of established history of British premiership. And you think there ought to be a museum of British premiership, which I think sounds a marvellous idea. Has anybody taken you up on that?
Well, they are thinking about it and talking about it, but Number 10 is effectively a military fortress. 20 years ago, exactly, the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, had a mortar attack on it, and the Prime Minister, John Major, was very nearly killed if the bomb had been 3 to 4 feet closer to the building. He would quite possibly have been killed together with his key cabinet members. So it has to be a fortress, so we can't go inside it. But if you have a complete replica, then people could. And I think this matters, because I think cynicism of prime ministers and leaders is somehow dissipated if people can see what buildings are like. It's the sense that you're being pushed away at number 10 behind heavy iron steel-enforced doors that create that sense that the PM is somehow not there as the democratic leader. And, you know, I think democracy is fantastic. There ought to be much more education about it in schools across the country. I think I'd love to see less cynicism about them. They're just people trying to do their best. Often, of course, some are corrupt, but the great majority are not. And if we could see more about how they operate, I think that would just spread a sense of trust and, dare I say, respect.
Yes, I think it's a marvellous idea. We have something like that at our old Parliament House. Look, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
That's another thing we could learn from you.
We won't labour that point too much. Look, thank you very much indeed for joining us, Sir Anthony.
Geraldine, an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Sir Anthony Seldon. He's also the honorary historian, by the way, at number 10. And his latest book is The Impossible Office? The History of the British Prime Minister. It's published by Cambridge University Press. And he's also presenting the major BBC program on this. So watch out for that if you can access it. And by the way, Andrew Adonis, the writer in Prospect magazine, has also done an accompanying little essay on the sort of opposite question, I suppose, the mirror image, the fate of the UK's opposition leaders, which is really quite entertaining. You might like to check it out.